This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
This program is made possible in part by Cable Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea. Introducing Pete's E-Cups, letting you send a warm gesture that says a lot. On the web at Pete's.com. That's P-E-E-T-S.
We're proud to be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Delanderos Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the city of Portland is looking at rainwater harvesting. The House and Senate negotiators have reached an agreement on the Patriot Act. And insurgents say they killed an American while dozens are killed and wounded in an Iraq bus attack.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,134 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 42,000 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports up to 30,877 civilians have been reported killed since the military intervention in Iraq began. Last year, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah since the invasion. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, December 8th, 2005. I'm Tom Knipe.
And I'm Noah Eaton. This Saturday at noon, activists will converge on downtown Portland to protest against the World Trade Organization's ministerial conference in Hong Kong. It's expected to be one of the biggest anti-WTO events in the country. The International Trade Organization meets next week to hammer out trade agreements on a variety of topics. Throughout this week, the KBOO News has interviewed local activists on WTO issues. Tonight, we have live in Studio 2, Lori Ann Bird of Northwest Resistance Against Genetic Engineering, also called Northwest Rage. Lori, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So, how does the issue of genetic engineering relate to the World Trade Organization?
Well, for starters, there's the problem of believing that food is just another commodity, like clothing or car parts. Remember, for the WTO, everything's a commodity, and this is a trade body that's highly secretive and undemocratic. It's the wrong institution to decide what we're eating. In the U.S., GE food started slipping into our food supply in the 90s, largely unnoticed. Today, 70% of the food on our supermarket shelves is genetically engineered. In Europe, it was a little bit different. There was a lot of debate. There continues to be a lot of debate. On May 13, 2003, the U.S. filed a complaint with the WTO against the European Union for their de facto moratorium on genetically engineered food. In May of 2004, the European Commission was basically forced to lift the moratorium by allowing genetically engineered maize. Without going into specifics of trade rules and patents, this example is one way that the WTO impacts what we eat and forces genetically engineered foods onto consumers.
So tell us about Northwest Rage for a moment and the work that you've done in the past.
Well, Northwest Rage is a nonviolent, all-volunteer grassroots collective. We're dedicated to promoting sustainable agriculture and ridding the earth of this unsafe, corporate-driven experiment. We promote active resistance to genetically engineered foods and genetically engineered organisms through education, advocacy, and action. You can check us out at www.nwrage.org. Some of the things that we've been involved with in the past have been restaurant campaigns, a land pledge campaign, the highly successful Trader Joe's campaign. They're currently the only supermarket in the U.S. that has no genetically engineered organisms in their house brand. And right now we're launching a campaign on genetically engineered creeping bent grass to make sure that it never becomes deregulated.
Oh, amen to that. So I understand that there's many listeners out there who are probably curious about this and hope that some of those genetically modified organisms aren't lying in the Aunt Polly's sweet potato casserole. So tell us about your plans for December 10th.
Well, members of Northwest Resistance Against Genetic Engineering are going to be meeting at the Fountain on the Waterfront at 11:30. You can join us there, or you can join us on the street at noon when we converge with the rest of the march. We're going to be bringing banners, signs, and we'll be wearing our bio suits. So please come out on Saturday and join us as we stand in solidarity.
Oh, bio suits, gotta love that. Thank you, Lori.
Thank you.
That was Lori Ann Bird of Northwest Rage. Portland's anti-WTO protest is Saturday, December 10th at noon at Southwest 1st and Salmon Streets.
Indigenous communities and women throughout Latin America are focusing new energies and strategies to take the lead in their struggle to counter the international cooperation in their lives. Veteran Chilean journalist Margarita Plaza Vargas, who closely covered the Zapatista movement in Mexico, said indigenous peoples and women are creatively challenging the consumer model. KBOO's Eduardo de Landeros Tiere has more on last night's informal talk in downtown Portland.
While the World Trade Organization Ministerial Conference is setting up in Hong Kong this December 13th, indigenous peoples and women throughout Latin America will be challenging those international corporate meetings with their own creative struggle to keep their local jobs and their lands in one democratic peace. The spirit of these indigenous challenges, in which women continue to take leadership roles, is the Zapatista movement within Mexico. The Mexican federal government for decades paid no attention to the Indios, while at the same time lauding Aztec art and doing lip service to their pride of Indian blood, but with no real benefits to its peoples, such as jobs, land, ongoing destruction of their natural resources, and racism against them. So, the Zapatista movement decided to take their land and their culture back. The Mexican federal government still is perplexed by the tactics of the Zapatista movement. Expecting the guerrilla tactics of arms and skirmishes, the Zapatista movement instead uses extremely effective grassroots organizing in independent yet connected mobilizations. The government has often been in a catch-up game with the Zapatistas. The pressure is on, too, since the Hong Kong WTO is being pushed by Mexican President Vicente Fox as the hope for jobs and consumerism. Margarita Plaza Vargas, a veteran independent journalist from Chile, covered the Zapatistas for over 8 years. The highly critical and experienced reporter soon was impressed by the Zapatistas. The journalist found that the movement made use of creative ideas and strategies, and found that women had taken on real leadership roles.
No, que no soy activista, soy militante. No, que es una diferencia.
I need to say I am not an activist, I am a militant. That's a fundamental difference between changes in Brazil. We are militants. By militants, I mean to have choices about life, 24 hours a day, choices about our bodies and our hearts to contribute to a better world.
Vargas is among those growing international journalists who have grown past the idea of a so-called objective journalist, while understanding that standard news is actually controlled, either subtly or not so subtly. The proactive journalist balances and allows their feelings about justice and human dignity to show in their coverage, but this still has to balance with maintaining the clarity of facts and criticism. It does work. And it has worked for Vargas. Vargas followed the Zapatista movement and actually saw real changes in the Mexican indigenous communities there. She also saw powerful leadership by women in a new way, a far new way than, say, how resistance movements from the 1950s and 60s saw women. This has meant a new type of resistance in Mexico, and it has troubled the Mexican government ever since. She covered the Zapatistas from San Cristobal to Chiapas.
I spent 8 years in Mexico living in houses, living with the people, but I always maintained my independence as a journalist in the alternative press. I didn't have to worry about any editorial limitations, so I chose to be a militant journalist.
Although most Latin American countries have bought into the idea that consumerism and the increasing money reach of international business is a benefit to a community, something that will thread through the Hong Kong WTO, grassroots villages, towns, communities are having second thoughts about having Walmart next to their farmlands. The Zapatistas speak in a new way of what they say as the word of those armed with truth and fire, or La Palabra de los Armados de Verdad y Fuego.
Que tenía mucho que aprender todavía, ¿no? Más que ayudar.
Well, I learned that there was a lot for me to learn. I had to learn past that part where I contributed. It was this learning process for me, as a woman, as a South American woman, as a woman with my own history. I grew up when Chile was under dictatorship. I knew I had to deal with that and learn something new, a new way of thinking.
The fire is there, but the truth comes first, not just as a moral symbol, but as a weapon, according to the Zapatistas. It's been working. They are armed with the truth, and this is more important to them than, say, guns or any other arms. Although they are organized as an army, the premise is one aiming to win by truth. At the heart of this new movement called the Zapatista Movement is the youth and their elders. They are forming a new dialogue, a new alliance. It's this new alliance that will form and bring together a new kind of local community. This community, this indigenous community, will protect their food, their lands, and their culture. It's a powerful counter to what is called corporate globalization. I'm Eduardo de Landeros Tierra, KBOO News.
Rose Quarter janitors have launched a class action lawsuit to recover wages from alleged pay violations. KBOO's Lisa Loving has more.
Janitors employed in the Rose Quarter yesterday won a major victory in their fight for fair pay when a Multnomah County judge approved their class action lawsuit against Service Master of Swan Island. Felisa Higgins of the Service Employees International Union explains.
Service Master Swan Island is the cleaning company that is in charge of the Rose Garden and the Memorial Coliseum. And specifically, the suit alleges that the cleaning company at the Rose Quarter required 11 workers to arrive sometimes up to an hour early to work without being permitted to clock in.
Hagen says forcing service employees to work off the clock is a problem around the nation.
We've seen this in other cities. Houston is an example. Los Angeles is another example. We've seen other examples of violations of workers' rights. And when you don't have any recourse through a grievance procedure or something like that, workers tend to be fearful of coming forward with these types of allegations. And I would say that these workers have really shown strength in coming forward to address the issue at the Rose Garden and the Memorial Coliseum to stand up for their rights to receive fair pay for their work.
Service Master of Swan Island deferred comment about the case to their attorney, Rick Van Cleve. He was unavailable for comment at press time. Community activists this week rallied outside the offices of Global Spectrum, manager of both the Rose Garden and the Coliseum, which is owned by the City of Portland. The activists say Global Spectrum is considering renewing Service Master's contract. For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving.
The City of Portland tonight holds its monthly Green Home Forum, sponsored by the City of Portland's Office of Sustainable Development. The topic is rainwater harvesting. Local ecologist Ole Erson will be there, and he joins us now live on the phone. Thanks for being with us, Ole.
Thank you.
Great. How does one harvest rainwater?
Well, basically, you simply catch any rainwater that flows off your roof or any other impermeable surface. A rainwater harvesting system can be as simple as a barrel or something at the bottom of your downspout to catch the rain. You can either dip the water out as it fills up or let it flow out into the garden by gravity. More complex systems can have larger storage cisterns and sometimes incorporate water treatment features such as filtering or pumps to pressurize the water so it can be used above the cistern.
I see. We understand your home uses no City of Portland water at all. Is that right?
Well, that's not entirely accurate. The system we've used at our Southeast Portland home has a 1,500-gallon cistern. For our family of five, that's equivalent to about 20 days of household use. Therefore, if the weather's dry for longer than 20 days, we're likely to use up all the water in our cistern, and then we have to revert back to the City of Portland water. Now, Portland typically gets 30 to 40 inches of rain per year. Since our home's roof is about 1,200 square feet, that means we get about 29,000 gallons of water on our roof each year. Now, that's enough to fill our cistern about 20 times, but mostly comes in the cooler months, so in the summertime we usually use city water also.
Do you have a sense of how many Portlanders are like you and harvest rainwater for use in their either in their homes or in their gardens? Or
well, I've met dozens, probably. Not everyone is doing the sort of thing that we're doing, actually using it in our house for all household purposes. But I think there are probably hundreds of people, maybe even thousands in the city, who have rain barrels. And
do you happen to know of anybody who's completely off of Portland water?
In the city of Portland, no. I do know some people in Newburgh who have about 10,000 gallons of storage, and they're completely off well water. So they're completely reliant on rainwater.
So tell us about what you'll be doing tonight at the Green Home Forum.
Well, my task tonight is to inspire people to rediscover rain as a resource that can enhance our environment, both with its utility and its beauty. Anyone can intercept their downspouts and use the flowing rain to create fountains, ponds, swales, or other water features to beautify their homes, gardens, and workplaces. And depending on how much you want to use water as a resource, you can either water your landscape, flush your toilets, wash your clothes, or even run your whole house on rainwater. There will be two designers tonight and a representative from the city also that can answer questions regarding building codes.
Great.
It would be great to see some KBOO listeners there tonight.
Thanks, Ole.
You're welcome.
That was Ole Erson. The Green Home Forum is from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at the Portland Community College Central Workforce Training Center next to OMSI, 1626 Southeast Water Avenue. The event is free.
New numbers released by the state say there are nearly 11,300 homeless students now in Oregon. But the Department of Education says the real number may be higher because students from transient families are hard to track. But totals don't include children younger than five, nor those who came to Oregon after Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. It is the first time that the state has done a formal release of district-by-district totals of homeless students to comply with federal education laws. The term homeless doesn't mean just students who live with their families on the street. It could also mean those who live in shelters, in pay-by-the-week city motels, in their cars, or who simply couch surf with friends and relatives.
Oregon's fight to reduce hunger could take a major hit if Congress approves House-proposed cuts to the food stamp program. KBOO's Noah Eaton reports.
Oregon will get hit especially hard if Congress approves proposed cuts to food stamps. That's according to a new analysis from the Oregon Center for Public Policy. It shows at least 14% of the cuts would come in Oregon, while the state accounts for just 2% of the nation's food stamp usage. The center's Michael Leachman says that means at least 35,000 low-income Oregonians would be going without.
Over the last 5 years, Oregon's hunger rate has fallen to a rate that's quite similar to the national rate. And we've done that primarily by expanding the food stamp program. We're headed in the right direction on hunger. These cuts threaten to push us back in the wrong direction.
Leachman also says other programs could also be affected, like fresh produce credits for low-income seniors and free and reduced-price school lunches, because they're based on food stamp eligibility.
If we cut food stamps for these families, they may lose access to these additional benefits. So it has kind of a domino effect.
The cuts are contained in the proposed House budget. The Senate proposal protects food stamps. Congress is expected to reconcile those two bills and vote on a final bill sometime this month. Content was provided by the Oregon News Service. I'm Noah Eaton, KBOO News. People in Oregon have been arrested as part of a 9-year federal investigation targeting eco-terrorists. The U.S. Justice Department's department says the investigation is continuing to other cases. One indictment alleges 28-year-old Chelsea Don Garlich knocked down an 80-foot Bonneville Power Administration transmission tower outside Bend in late 1999. She was arrested in Portland and faces up to 25 years in prison if convicted. 36-year-old Kevin Tubbs was arrested in Springfield on indictments alleging he had helped set fire in 1998 to the Animal and Plant and Health Inspection Services facility in Olympia, Washington. Authorities are still working to extradite Michael Scarpitti from Canada, saying he had participated in firebombing of logging and cement trucks in Oregon.
Portland General Electric has been ordered to justify its rate-setting practices to city officials at a winter forum. City commissioners contend that PGE collected $672 million from ratepayers to cover the utility's income taxes, but never actually paid the money. The commissioners are also checking into roughly $245 million in bankruptcy claims against PGE's parent, Enron. PGE officials say the utility's rates and finances are above board. Chief Executive Officer Peggy Fowler told the Oregonian after the meeting that she is getting impatient with the accusations. State rules let utilities collect money from ratepayers to cover tax liabilities. Meanwhile, a circuit court will hear PGE motions to dismiss a class action lawsuit for charging ratepayers over $7 million for Multnomah County business income taxes. Noah?
Oregon Physicians for Responsibility announced victory in their campaign to persuade Microsoft to stop using PVC plastic in its packaging and manufacturing. This is significant for Oregon, where an estimated 25,000 tons of PVC are incinerated or landfilled every year. Studies show links between chemicals and PVC and cancer, reproductive and immune system damage, and asthma. Nevertheless, it's the second biggest selling plastic in the world. Eugene Firefighters Association Local 851 strongly supports the campaign against the plastic, which typically releases hydrochloric acid and dioxin when burned. That's a critical but often overlooked danger during house fires. Next, the group has started working with Oregon affiliates of Habitat for Humanity to use safer building materials in low-income housing.
Current time is 5:21. Still to come on the KBOO Evening News, Schwarzenegger meets lawyers for Stanley Williams, who hope the California governor will spare his life. Education or exploitation? New Orleans business to offer Katrina tours. And Rumsfeld says U.S. troop levels likely to drop after Iraqi elections. You're listening to Community Radio, KBOO, in Portland, Vancouver, Corvallis, and Hood River.
Congressional negotiators have reached agreement to extend key provisions of the nation's anti-terrorism law, but no senator plans to try to block it. Wisconsin Democrat Russ Feingold says a bill doesn't include, quote, adequate safeguards for civil liberties. Feingold was the only senator to vote against the original version. He's warning of a possible filibuster. Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Arlen Specter says a deal calls for four-year extensions of two critical provisions of the act. They cover roving wiretaps and secret searches for books, records, and other documents. Specter says he does not think a filibuster will succeed if there is one.
If the Iraqi elections are peaceful next week, 23,000 American troops should get their tickets home. Pentagon officials say this is not a pullout or a concession to critics of the American presence in Iraq. While on Capitol Hill this morning to meet with lawmakers, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld characterized it as a planned rollback to where force levels were before the election campaign hit high gear. Rumsfeld says troop levels will drop from 160,000 to 137,000. Pentagon officials are also hinting that it's quite possible there could be a bigger troop drawdown if conditions permit, and that it wouldn't have to wait till the election-related forces come home.
The House Judiciary Committee approved an anti-immigration measure that will make it easier to deport immigrants and take steps toward militarizing the border. Yet the bill does nothing to address the status of the some 11 million undocumented immigrants living and working in the U.S. FSRN's Mitch Dreserus reports from Capitol Hill.
Mr. Chairman, there are 23 ayes and 15 noes.
And the motion to report the bill favorably as amended is agreed to.
With that, a Republican proposal to toughen immigration laws and enforcements took a big step forward in making undocumented immigrants criminals by turning any immigration violation into a crime. Tracy Hong is with the National Asian Pacific American Legal Consortium.
An F1 student who is in the United States to go to a university or a college drops a class because he finds that he has, you know, he's taken one too many classes and drops below the full course load needed. That person has all of a sudden become an aggravated felon.
The measure also attempts to make it harder for employers to hire undocumented immigrants. It would require all employers to verify the legal status of all of their workers. Maria Elena Incapi is with the National Immigration Law Center.
It's going to push undocumented immigrants into the underground cash economy for exploitation because there's no path to citizenship or a means of getting work authorization under this bill.
The measure does not address, however, what to do with the some 11 million undocumented immigrants already living in the United States. But it would call for local law enforcement to enact immigration laws upon them. James Sensenbrenner is a Republican chair of the House Judiciary Committee.
Amnesty only encourages more people to come to the United States illegally, whether it's illegal entry under the fence or illegal entry and then overstaying a visa.
But one Republican, Jeff Flake of Arizona, says it's unrealistic to think that they'll all be deported.
For those who say, well, let's just pretend that they're not here. Let's keep them in the shadows. That's more of an amnesty than anything,
right,
in my view. To pretend that they're not here and say, let's just, you know, I'll count to 100, and if you can go back to your home country and apply from there, then we're not going to give you amnesty. That's simply wrong, and we shouldn't be engaging in that charade.
The entire House will vote on the immigration bill next week. Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News, the Capitol.
The House passed three tax cut bills yesterday and will consider another bill intended to do the same today. FSRN's Wendy Wang reports from Washington, D.C.
H.R. 4297, the Tax Relief Extension Reconciliation Act of 2005, extends current tax cut provisions that are due to expire. Supporters of the bill say they are important to small businesses and families. One provision is intended to support lower rates on capital gains and dividends. This extension of the investment tax breaks, currently set to expire in 2008, comes at a time when lawmakers want to reduce the budget deficit. But critics say the investment tax breaks primarily benefits upper-income individuals, not middle-income families and small businesses. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Wendy Wang.
Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa appointed business leader Estela Lopez today as executive.
California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger held a private clemency hearing for Stan Tookie Williams today. Lawyers are not giving any details on their meeting and neither are prosecutors. Supporters argue that Williams is an international peacemaker, a six-time Nobel Peace Prize nominee, and an effective role model and mentor for at-risk youth. FSRN's Sarah Olson takes a look at just how effective Tookie's work has been in working with kids and gang violence.
The Neighborhood House of North Richmond in California is a busy place. It offers programs addressing housing, education, employment, economic self-sufficiency, and personal health. One of its programs is the Internet Project for Street Peace, which uses the life and work of Stan Tookie Williams to help low-income and at-risk youth say no to gang violence.
Sometimes when I go outside and play, I always see people selling drugs, killing, fighting.
That's Luis Camacho. He's 11. He says this type of thing is somewhat common in his neighborhood. His older sister Fanny is affected by the violence too. Part of what they've both learned from Williams is how to understand where gang violence comes from.
The stuff I have seen here is like kind of sad because people be fighting over colors and gangs, and that's not right. Colors don't mean nothing.
Gang colors may not mean anything to Fanny Camacho, but Richmond was recently ranked 11th most violent city in the United States. Most of this violence is due to gangs, and Fanny agrees they seem to be everywhere. Renika Dowell is another student involved in the program. She's 14.
When I was going to elementary school, it was this one killing when they had it like right there, the path that I had to take to go to school, and the body was just laying there. The violence is just, it's crazy.
Richmond High School junior Edgar Medina says it's hard to find adults who believe in young people, and there are few role models. There is a lot of peer pressure to join gangs, police don't seem to protect the community, and the mayor of Richmond recently told local media that young people don't appear to respect human life.
Many teenagers, you could say, want you to get involved into drugs or gangs, but I try to avoid it. That's why I feel like violence is not part of me. That's something I believe that Tookie has helped me believe.
And infallibly, each of the students involved with the Internet Project for Street Peace cites the work of Stan Tookie Williams as essential to their survival. Literally. Here's Renika Dowell.
He stopped me from following his footsteps because if I ever thought about being in the gang, I would change my mind just because of the spoken words that came from his mouth.
Marquita Griffin, a Richmond High School junior, agrees. She says Williams' books are powerful tools to help inspire kids, especially in areas where the school district is underfunded, gang violence is already prevalent, and kids don't often see many options for themselves.
When I read the books, it makes you not want to join the gang because you see what's happening to him now, and you don't want to go through the same thing. And he's trying to stop people from doing that. And it seemed like most of the people is listening to him and they're trying to stop it.
Griffin also says Williams has helped her see one reason for gang violence in her neighborhood is lack of jobs. When people feel hopeless, she says, they turn to violence.
Yeah, there's a lot of people out there that's struggling. Some people lost their jobs and ain't got houses to live in and stuff, so they just sleeping out there on the streets and stuff.
Even though the students in Richmond have adopted Williams as a role model, the state of California continues to view him as a violent criminal and has scheduled his execution for Tuesday, December 13th. This perplexes Fanny Camacho.
Why would they kill people that haven't lived their whole life? He's wanting to show people that what he did in the past was wrong, and he doesn't want people to kill him.
Edgar Medina doesn't want the state to kill Williams either. He's afraid of what will happen to young people in Richmond if Williams is executed.
If he dies, like, it's going to feel like everything we did was not worth doing because he's died anyway. So I believe that if he dies, many people will be devastated and they will feel like, what's the point of trying if you still going to fail?
For Free Speech Radio News in Richmond, California, I'm Sarah Olson.
The same group that offers visitors a chance to drive by some of New Orleans' massive old homes will soon allow them to see some mass devastation. Gray Line New Orleans next month will begin a Hurricane Katrina bus tour, taking visitors through some of the city's hardest hit areas. The tour will cost $35, with $3 going to a nonprofit group directly affected by the monster storm. Some city residents say the company is exploiting a tragedy. One man says the company is treating Katrina's wreckage like a theme park. The company's general manager says people would not fully understand the scope of the damage until they saw it for themselves.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try.
Paul McCartney is among those remembering John Lennon on the 25th anniversary of his death. He calls Lennon, quote, one of the great men of the 20th century. In an interview with BBC Radio, he says the anniversary brings back memories of the, quote, horrific conditions of Lennon's death. In New York, hundreds have gathered in Central Park's Strawberry Fields across from the Dakota apartment building where Lennon lived and was killed. He was gunned down outside the building by a deranged fan. The scene was much the same in Lennon's hometown of Liverpool, England. Scores of fans from around the world remembered him with white balloons, flowers, and prayers. The balloons carrying written tributes to Lennon were released into the sky. God bless you, Lennon, and may you forever rest in peace.
And no religion, too. Imagine all the people living life in peace, you.
The current time is 5:33, and now daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
It's obvious even to a casual observer that the Lord works his wonders in mysterious ways. You could ask Jim Inhofe about that. Inhofe, the right-wing Oklahoma Republican who chairs the Senate Environment Committee, is the favorite pet of corporate polluters whose industrial emissions are cited by scientists as the leading cause of global warming. Not only has Inhofe stifled every congressional effort to control these emissions, but he also has called the very idea of corporate involvement in global warming the greatest hoax ever perpetrated on the American people. So far, Inhofe has been able to ignore science, but what ho! Now he finds himself confronted by a formidable and surprising new force, evangelical Christians. Within the National Association of Evangelicals, representing 45,000 churches serving 30 million members, is a burgeoning evangelical environmental network that is taking seriously the biblical mandate for humans to be good stewards of the earth. Indeed, these mainstream evangelicals are now considering a draft policy statement calling on Congress to pass mandatory controls on global warming emissions. Good God Almighty, you can almost hear Inhofe shout. In his political career, he has always touted himself as a devout evangelical, and he certainly did not expect this curveball from God. So far, his reaction has been to assail the messengers. Sticking with his corporate sponsors, Inhofe calls the claim that Christians should work to stop activities harmful to God's creation as something very strange. And he dismisses the evangelicals' biblical citations for their work, saying, "You can always find in scriptures a passage to misquote for almost anything." This is Jim Hightower saying, the evangelicals don't choose to call their work environmentalism, preferring the phrase creation care. But forget the labels, it's the message that's important. You can hear the word at creationcare.org. Support for this program comes from the Progressive Magazine, featuring columnists Miley Ivins, Howard Zinn, and Barbara Ehrenreich, with features and information available at progressive.org.
Stay tuned for independent native news following our newscast. Then at 6 p.m., hear Voices of the Middle East with Gudars Ekhtadari. Tonight, a live interview by Dr. Lisa Hahar about CIA practices of secret detentions and interrogations, and Dr. Leila Al-Mariyadi on struggles that American Muslims face in the U.S. today. At 7 is Good Times with Reggae Bob. Tonight's weather, a clear sky with a low around 30. Tomorrow, sunshine with a high between 40 and 45. You are listening to the KABU Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
More victims of a suicide bomber on a bus in Baghdad have died, bringing the death toll to 32. Officials also say 44 people were wounded when someone set off an explosives belt among passengers heading to a Shiite city. Most of those who died were aboard the vehicle, but several people at a nearby food stall also were killed. Several other explosions rumbled through the heart of the capital this morning, including one that struck an American convoy, killing a U.S. soldier.
An Iraqi militant group has posted a statement on the internet saying it has killed a kidnapped U.S. security consultant. The claim has not been verified, but the militants say they'll post pictures of the killing later. The group says it's killed a man because the U.S. has not released Iraqi prisoners as it demanded. The Islamic Army released a video 2 days ago showing an industrial electrician from Alaska sitting with his hands tied behind his back.
And in a video released earlier today, the kidnappers of four peace activists in Iraq said they would allow 48 more hours for their demands to be met before executing their captives. FSRN's David Enders reports from Amman, Jordan.
The most recent video footage from the kidnappers showed two of the men wearing orange jumpsuits and handcuffs. The captives are Canadians James Loney and Harmeet Singh Sudin, American Tom Fox, and Briton Norman Kember. They were abducted on November 26th in Baghdad. The men are members of the Christian Peace Team, a Quaker pacifist group that has worked all over the world using direct nonviolent action to protest against and stop violence. CPT established a presence in Baghdad before the U.S. invasion in hopes of helping to stop the war, and were among the first groups to make public evidence of U.S. torture in Abu Ghraib prison and other detention centers around the country. In recent months, they have been focusing their energies on abuses being committed by the U.S.-backed Iraqi government. The group's work in Iraq and Palestine has resulted in wide-ranging appeals for their release, from dozens of Iraqi groups to the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem to Abu Qatada, a cleric in London who is currently incarcerated by the British government for his anti-government sermons. Anas Al-Tikriti, the head of the Muslim Association of Britain, spent the last 5 days in Baghdad appealing for the release of the four activists by pressuring different Iraqi groups to release statements on their behalf and talking to English and Arabic media. The kidnappers have demanded the release of all prisoners in U.S. and Iraqi custody, as well as the withdrawal of British troops, in exchange for the release of the hostages. Tikriti is hopeful that the extension of the deadline means the kidnapping might be resolved without any loss of life.
I'd like to think that as a result of this incessant pressure, media pressure, as well as contacts and the such, that the message did get through. It's also good in a sense that if we were to follow the hostage-taking incidents of the past, whenever there was an extension to an initial deadline, usually, more or less, the outcome was good. I actually appealed for a stay of execution or an extension to the deadline. But regardless of of what led to what. I think that generally speaking, the outcome is good. But it means we have now around 48 hours to do more work and to contact more people and to hammer a new message. And the new message is that I've started to speak of as of last night is that there's a lot of sympathy with the demand made by the kidnappers.
As the deteriorating security situation in Iraq forced most Westerners to hire guards in armored cars, CPT had continued to work from an unprotected apartment in central Baghdad. Peggy Gish is a CPT member from Ohio who has spent 18 months in Iraq. She says that even if her colleagues are not released, she would like to see the group maintain a presence in the country.
We've always known that it was possible for this to happen. I mean, we're very realistic about the dangers. We're there. We see it. And yet we choose to go in. We choose to take that risk. If military personnel are willing to take the risks to be there to work for war, why shouldn't peace people be willing to take that same risk for peace?
In Amman, I'm David Enders reporting for FSRN.
Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and European leaders reached for détente Thursday in the war on words over whether the U.S. has gone too far in pursuit of terrorists. However, she gave no guarantees that detainees would not be abused again. European Foreign Minister said Rice had, quote, cleared the air by assuring NATO allies the U.S. does not allow torture of terrorist suspects and respects principles of the Geneva Conventions on the treatment of prisoners of war. The comments came on her final day of meetings with European leaders on a trip that has seen the spotlight stolen daily by questions about secret CIA prisons in Eastern Europe and U.S. policy on torture-like practices. But this does not necessarily portend that the uproar would subside on either side of the Atlantic Ocean. Today's comments by Rice and the European diplomats seem to indicate both sides seem content to agree to disagree on some issues, at least for now.
After completing 4 months of training with the U.S. Marines, a battalion of 550 Georgian soldiers is now to be deployed to Iraq. The operation is in step with Georgia's strategic alliance with the U.S. and its ambitions to join NATO. However, as FSRN's Guy Dagan reports, critics say that with a high rate of unemployment and continued corruption, the media is under pressure to critique the government and to ignore domestic reforms which require greater attention.
The approval rating of Georgia's Mikhail Saakashvili may be over 70%, but national unemployment is widely believed to be as high, if not higher. And while the National Police Force has
really
undergone reforms,
that
Amnesty International says that the use of torture by Georgia's police is still a problem, and the government should keep the eradication of torture and ill treatment as a priority. While insisting that the police force is improving, Foreign Minister Gelo Beshuavili concedes that ill-treatment of people by police could still be occurring.
We are not saying that there are no cases, but we need to treat it on a case-by-case basis. There are not massive human rights violations in Georgia anymore.
The Georgian government has also stressed that within the past 2 years it has reduced corruption, particularly at a low level of administration. However, critics argue that the government exceeds the law in order to get things done, often in the name of reform. Mark Mullen is the chairman of Transparency International in Georgia. He notes that the $295 million of US funding that Georgia will soon receive through the Millennium Challenge account is an example of where the government is not setting a good example of transparent administration.
We worry that somehow, because there don't seem to be very strict transparency provisions on it, and because the method by which Washington and Millennium Challenge Georgia are making decisions between themselves with nobody else discussing it, that a lot of that money might get lost.
Of perhaps greater concern is legal reform and the guaranteeing of independence of Georgia's courts. Several judges recently spoke out about being coerced into resigning by the government. It's widely known that some judges may have been tainted by corruption during the Shevardnadze era. But Anna Dolitsa, chair of the Young Georgian Lawyers Association, says that corrupt judges should be prosecuted in accordance with the law and not just asked to quietly resign.
Judges of the Supreme Court, the top court in the country, are being threatened, are being sabotaged, and their rights are being violated. What can we do? whether will our rights be protected by this court, with this kind of courts. That's why I think a debate, a public debate, an acute one sometimes, a critical one, is totally necessary, because only through public discussions can the government get the plethora of ideas of how to go forward with the serious questions that it's confronted with.
Dolidze fears that such a public debate is not occurring in Georgia because the media is reluctant to criticise the government. Akaki Gogashvili agrees. An investigative journalist with Rustavi 2 Television's 60 Minutes, Gogashvili has a reputation for breaking big stories. However, since the election of the Saakashvili government, his team continues to produce stories, but the program is no longer broadcast. Gogashvili believes that because the station supported Saakashvili in the revolution, it does not want to offend the government. He argues that there is a culture of self-censorship in Georgia, and journalists are still being intimidated.
I know several of them who have been beaten. The government controls the situation. They just ban the journalists who are dangerous, who are not controllable from access to the public, and they can contain them, so to say.
With winter fast approaching, Georgia has won praise from the U.S. government for its financial preparation to meet the season's high energy costs. Dependency on Russia for energy still poses a big problem for Georgia. But while Georgians hope they'll have adequate light and heating over the winter, 2 years after their Rose Revolution, the high expectations for long-term reforms are now beginning to cool. In Tbilisi, Georgia, this is Guy Deegan for Free Speech Radio News.
The Geneva Convention has agreed on a new emblem to join the Red Cross and Red Crescent. Relief workers and ambulances bearing the Red Cross or Red Crescent symbols are protected under international law. Convention member states voted by a two-thirds majority for the diamond-shaped red crystal on a white background, ending a decades-old flap and opening the way for Israel to join. Israel had been denied entry because its Red Shield of David was not approved by the 1949 Geneva Conventions. The new symbol is regarded as being free from religious, national, or cultural connotations.
Retired General Antti Gotovina has been arrested in the Canary Islands. Gotovina is the third most wanted war crimes suspect from the former Yugoslavia and has been indicted by the Hague Tribunal for war crimes committed against Serbs in Croatia. FSRN's Zoran Čulević reports from Belgrade.
Earlier today in Belgrade, United Nations War Crimes Prosecutor Carla Del Ponte announced the arrest of retired General Antti Gotovina in Spain's Canary Islands. Del Ponte said that General Gotovina was apprehended in a joint effort by Spanish and Croatian police and is now in detention awaiting transfer to the Hague Tribunal. The indictment from the Hague Tribunal issued in 2001 alleges that the retired Croatian army general has been participated in a joint criminal enterprise, the common purpose of which was the forcible and permanent removal of the Serb population from Croatia. The main focus of his indictment is on atrocities committed during 1995, Croat offensive against the Croatian Serbs, codenamed Operation Storm, which some analysts allege was planned and coordinated by some top U.S. Army officials. General Gotovina is the Hague Tribunal's third most wanted suspect, after Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic and General Ratko Mladic. However, all of them are regarded as heroes in their native countries. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Zoran Čulević from Belgrade.
Thousands of people from around Italy have joined Susa Valley locals to oppose the construction of a major railway project in northwest Italian Alps. FSRN's Diletta Varlis has a story.
Around 40,000 demonstrators rallied today in Italy's Susa Valley in opposition to the construction of a high-speed railway. The demonstrators say the project is expensive, unnecessary, and will damage the environment. Today's march ended in the town of Venaus, where the first tunnel of the rail project is to be constructed. Riot police were deployed to prevent protesters from occupying the construction site. Hundreds of locals, separated into small groups, reached the site via alternative path and began a sit-in. The defense minister and the interior minister characterized demonstrators as useless rioters, and Prime Minister Berlusconi has called them dangerous communists and terrorists. But the Susa Valley residents are receiving strong support and solidarity from all over Italy. A major demonstration is scheduled for Saturday the 17th. For Free Speech Radio News, Diletta Varlese, Italy.
The time is 49 minutes past 5 o'clock, and now on today's Earthwatch report, a vanishing act in the Arctic.
The disappearance of ice on the Arctic Ocean seems to be speeding up year after year. I'm Richard Hoops for Earthwatch Radio. Satellite images reveal that the ice cover on the Arctic Ocean is getting smaller every year. Climate experts say that might start a chain of events that will melt all the ice and change the Arctic forever. Mark Serez works at the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Boulder, Colorado, and he specializes in the study of the Arctic climate. He says the vast expanse of ice over the Arctic Ocean is bright white and reflects a lot of solar energy back into space. Serez has analyzed more than 20 years of satellite images that show the steady shrinking of this reflective ice cover. That means more of the Arctic Ocean is exposed every summer, and the dark water absorbs solar energy. It could start a trend towards warmer water every summer and thinner ice every winter. Ultimately, it could lead to the total disappearance of the ice during the summer months. The Arctic Ocean is still covered by a lot of ice during the summer, and the ice cover still expands during the winter. But Serez says the winter ice is not as thick and extensive as it was 10 or 20 years ago, and he says this trend might be irreversible.
We have lost enough of the Arctic's sea ice cover now so that we just can't recover anymore. We've pulled that sea ice cover back. We've exposed a lot of this dark open ocean that can absorb now a lot of solar energy. Well, we've gotten to this point now where we've lost enough sea ice cover so that we really have started to bump up that ocean heat content, and it seems to me that it's going to be very difficult for the sea ice to recover at this point.
Serez says these changes to the Arctic Ocean might accelerate the general warming trend that's already underway in the far north. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Sea Grant Program and the Nelson Institute at the University of Wisconsin.
Police in southern Mowally have wounded two people after shooting into a crowd trying to force their way into a food depot to buy maize. A local child welfare official blamed food shortages for Wednesday's incident. Mowally is the worst hit of six countries in southern Africa facing serious food shortages. Government and aid agencies say up to 5 million Mowallians, nearly half the population, will need urgent food aid until the next harvest in April of next year.
The United Nations Security Council has condemned Eritrea over its plans to expel European and North American peacekeepers from its disputed border with Ethiopia. It said the order for the troops to leave within 10 days was unacceptable. There's been no explanation for Eritrea's decision to expel the peacekeepers. The two states went to war in 1998. A peace deal in 2000 led to a border ruling by an independent commission. Movement of troops closer to the border by both sides over the last months have raised fears of a new war.
And that's the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, December 8th, 2005. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Jamie Heim. Tonight's audio editor is myself. Special thanks to reporters Eduardo Delanderos Tierre, Noah Eaton, and Lisa Loving. Our engineer is Jamie Heim. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Noah Eaton.
And I'm Tom Knipe. Stay tuned for Independent Native News. And coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., it's the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30, it's Ani and Melody hosting Positively Revolting Talk Radio. And at 9 tomorrow morning, it's Marlena's Electronic Salon. She'll talk with local naturopath Dr. Stephen Bailey and take your calls about health concerns. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. That's all right here on KBOO, your community, nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored radio station. Thanks for joining us.
This is Independent Native News for Thursday, the 8th of December. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. In Northwest Alaska, a predominantly Native jury has returned a guilty verdict against a former Nome police officer at his retrial for murdering a young Inupiat woman while on duty. KNOM's Paul Korchin reports.
Superior Court Judge Ben Esch received the verdict forms from the jury Tuesday afternoon, examined them briefly, and read them aloud.
We, the jury, duly impaneled and sworn to try the above-entitled case, find defendant Matthew Owens guilty of the crime of murder in the first degree.
The 30-year-old Owens was convicted in the execution-style shooting two summers ago of 19-year-old Sonia Ivanov. Jurors also returned a guilty verdict against Owens for evidence tampering in connection with stealing a police car and faking shots fired to mislead murder investigators. The first trial in Nome last winter ended with a deadlocked jury. Kotzebue jurors deliberated for 3.5 days before pronouncing judgment. Larry and Maggie Ivanov indicated Owens's conviction for the death of their daughter brings hope for personal and communal healing.
I'm just so grateful that no one will have to go through what we went through with him, that he's behind bars.
A sentencing date for Owens will be set next week. Lead prosecutor Richard Svobodny says the state will ask for the maximum against the cop-turned-killer.
Well, everybody in this courtroom knows that if he's convicted, he's going to get 99 years. So I'm going to take him up on that, and that's exactly what we're going to be asking for.
Both trials took more than 6 weeks with over 80 witnesses. In Nome, I'm Paul Korchin.
In the Canadian Yukon, just across the Alaska border, the Little Salmon Carmax First Nation is worried about the safety of its water supply. As the CBC's Nancy Thompson reports, analysis by a Whitehorse engineering firm shows that nearly a third of the wells in the area are contaminated with bacteria.
Studies looked at all 72 wells used by the First Nation. It found that a third of them showed either naturally occurring bacteria or E. coli bacteria. A letter to the First Nation from the company last spring urges people with questionable wells to boil their water. It goes on to say persistent contamination of wells is a serious problem and could have negative health impacts. Jillian Chown is with Vistatech. She says right now the wells within the First Nation can't be considered safe and don't meet the Canadian drinking water safety guidelines.
And I'd be very concerned as a mother if I was preparing formula using the water from some of the wells here.
Chown says several factors combine to make the wells unreliable. They're shallow, located in sandy areas with a high water table, and are too close to septic fields. Chown says the wells are routinely treated with chlorine and tested every couple of months. But she says that's simply a band-aid solution to a chronic problem.
There's obviously health risks. It doesn't provide high-quality water for the residents. It's not a safe source of water.
Ed Skookum is chief of the Little Salmon Carmax First Nation. He says there is a long-term solution, a piped water system. But with an estimated price tag of $5 million, it's something Skookum says his government can't do alone. So until and unless that pipe system becomes a reality, people within the First Nation will have to rely on bottled water, boiling their well water, or hauling it from different sources. Nancy Thompson, Whitehorse.
The registrar at Haskell Indian Nations University in Lawrence, Kansas, wants to remind college-age Native Americans that an education is one of the best gifts you can give yourself. Pat Blank spoke with Haskell Registrar Manny King recently and files this story.
Manny King says many young people have a difficult time deciding to go to college because they have no role models.
Why get a degree when you can see your tribal chairman, your tribal councilman, you know, a lot of the people that are in key places on your government system, they're not even educated, you know, so why do you need to be educated?
King says some kids don't work or go to school because there's a monthly or yearly stipend from a casino, but there's no guarantee that will last.
Not everybody's casino rich. Those are, what, 10% of our Native population that take advantage of casinos.
Haskell in Lawrence, Kansas, offers 4 bachelor degrees. All 900 students are Native, including Samsoji Sampson from New York.
We have like all the different tribes from all over the U.S. We have like a bunch of people from Alaska too as well.
Sampson and King recently visited the University of Northern Iowa. Reporting from Cedar Falls, Iowa, this is Pat Blank.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by Ridolfi Incorporated, acting in partnership with Native Alaskan and Native American communities to clean up and restore ecosystems. RIDOLFI.com. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska.
And this is 15 seconds to 6 o'clock, and you're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. This is KBOO's The Voice of the Middle East. صوت الشرق الاوسط من اذاعه كيبل و صدای خاورمیانه از رادیو KBOO.
طلوا حبابنا طلوا نسيبنا بين ربوعنا خلوا تحت الزهرات جوال طلوا حبابنا طلوا بين ربوعنا فيات غنينا وعلى مياه لقينا على أقصى ما حلو من زمان طير الشام نحن حكايات في بال منا نغمات موال نحن حكايات
صلى صلى
نغمات موال نحن حكايات في بال منا نغمات موال
Welcome to another installment of Voices of the Middle East on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. I'm your host tonight, Gudarz Ektedari, and we have a website, www.voicesofthemiddleeast.com. The Voices of the Middle East is one word, and usually we have the interviews and programs from the past online that you can access and listen to on demand. Tonight I have a two-part program. The first portion is a recorded lecture that was made last week. Dr. Leila Al-Mariati, who is a past president of the Muslim Women's League and a gynecologist from Los Angeles, was in town attending an interfaith forum on Friday, and then she gave an informal lecture to the Muslim community at the Muslim Education Trust in Portland. And I was at the lecture and recorded this, and you are listening to an edited version of it. It was actually the audience were mostly Muslim community of Portland. So I hope that you enjoy that. And then later on, we will have a live interview with Dr. Lisa Hajjar, who is a professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara. The topic of that interview would be the CIA's secret detention and what is actually going on, which has very little, I guess, exposure in the U.S., but it's a big issue in Europe and especially in Germany. So with that, without further ado, let's go to the first part of the program. This is the Dr. Leila Al-Mariati, the spokesperson and past president of the Muslim Women's League, a Los Angeles-based organization dedicated to disseminating accurate information about Islam and women and for strengthening the role of Muslim women in society. Leila has served as presidential appointee to the Commission on International Religious Freedom from 1999 to 2001. And as an American of Palestinian descent, Dr. Al-Mariati frequently speaks about the right of the Palestinian. She's a member of the board of directors of A Kinder USA, which addresses the health and educational needs of Palestinian children living in the West Bank and Gaza.
Rahim, assalamu alaikum. I'm very glad to be here. It's my first time to visit Portland. I keep hearing that the summer is really nice, so this is so I shouldn't let the weather deter me from coming back, inshallah. We'll see if we have that opportunity. I thought that tonight we didn't really pin down any specific topic, but I thought that something that might be good for us to just engage in discussion about are looking at the challenges and opportunities that are before us as Muslims living in America. There are many, and so I'm just going to focus a little bit on some of the ones that I think are of importance, and then afterwards we can talk about other issues, if you like, that I didn't address. And some of them related to some of the experiences that I've had over the years related to the U.S. government, the other activities that I've been involved in and so forth, to just shed some light on that, and then we can hopefully have a good discussion. I think that when we look at the challenges or the obstacles that are before us, there are those that are external, imposed by the society that we live in, and the internal obstacles that we have imposed upon ourselves as a Muslim community. And so talking about external, of course, I don't have to tell everybody here, when you just look at just basic survival living in the United States, especially if people are, you know, immigrants and have questionable immigration status, that group has probably suffered the most after 9/11 in terms of uncertainty about their lives, separation from their families, deportations, people being disappeared right afterwards. And I think we have to sort of acknowledge really the devastating effect that had on certain elements of our community, sometimes that we didn't even know about, because it was happening in ways that were kept from us. But since that has happened, we're all dealing with sort of this overlying layer of suspicion that exists more or less in some places or others, depending on where you live, as to who we are as Muslims living in America. As you recall, in the aftermath of 9/11, there was a lot of effort to distinguish between, you know, groups who were engaged in violence and everybody else. But over time, it seemed like efforts to gain understanding, especially in the mainstream media, as well as within the government, particularly this administration, that those efforts diminished more and more. And so you had louder and louder voices that were articulating a more extreme vision and looking at, with complete negativity at Muslims, that as if we are really a fifth column and waiting to erupt at any time. I don't know if any of you have seen on television, but now starting, I think, this weekend on Showtime, they're going to have a series called Sleeper Cell, which is about a group of American Muslim terrorists that are plotting some horrible chemical weapon attack in the United States. But there, you know, whether this effort is deliberate on the part of certain groups, either politically or religious organizations and so forth, or whether it's just the media sort of capitalizing on a sensational story and getting the most out of it, the result is to do several things. And the main objective is to minimize the influence of Muslims in America and the American political arena by doing the following. Number one, minimizing our potential influence and downplaying our effectiveness. The Wall Street Journal had an interesting article talking about, you know, the role American Muslims are playing, and it was very positive in some ways, but they referred to our number as 2 million. You know, there's supposedly 500,000 Muslims in Los Angeles alone. How could, you know, one-fourth of the population of Muslims exist there. So there's a tendency to downplay even our demographic strength, to minimize people's attitude towards us, I would say, in the government, to look at, say, well, you don't really have to worry about Muslims as a constituency because there's only 2 million of them in the first place. The second is to demonize us, like in this movie and in other ways, to say, to get experts. This happens not only in the media, but it happens in Washington in ways that we don't often hear about, where they will have hearings and they'll bring experts like Steve Emerson. Does everybody know who Steve Emerson is? No, not everyone. I'll explain in a minute. And Daniel Pipes, both of whom prior to 9/11 have really displayed their colors as racist anti-Muslim zealots. They are not respected as scholars in academic circles by anybody whom they claim to be affiliated with. They're promoted by right-wing conservatives. And they're used. There was a hearing that the Senate Banking Finance Committee had talking about terrorist financing. And a spokesperson from the Treasury Department had invited Stephen Emerson to testify alongside him about Muslim charities and terrorist financing. And so we can't underestimate the impact that these kinds of individuals and groups have, the ones that promote them, on trying to undermine, again, our influence, exclude us from the political process that belongs to us as American citizens, but also to continue to demonize us and to tell one version of the story and to make allegations that don't have to ever be proven. There was another hearing recently by the Senate Justice Committee about the spread of Wahhabism in the United States. The Muslim Public Affairs Council, which I'll talk about a little bit at the end, I was able to have them postpone that and that hearing because the feeling was, what in the world is the Justice Committee doing talking about something that really should be the business of the International Relations Committee and so forth? And they ended up rescheduling it, and it was a little bit better because they had the person they had coming to represent the Muslim interest wasn't somebody that represented Muslims at all. And what this hearing was about a Freedom House study. Freedom House is an organization that looks at religious freedom around the world, pretty much mostly from the Christian perspective and from the very right-wing Christian perspective, had published a report last year on the existence of Wahhabi literature in mosques in the United States. So they had people going around to Islamic centers and masjids all around the United States and looking in their bookstores and writing down what literature they had and deciding X, Y, or Z was Wahhabi literature. And so then they reported this saying, you see, the spread of Wahhabism is in the United States. Because what they've done is, instead of talking about Islam as being bad, then they've shifted to Islamism, then they've shifted to Wahhabism, and now the new term is Islamofascism, if you haven't heard it already. Actually, President Bush used it in a speech that he gave. But there was a hearing here, and again, they're not inviting people from the community to come and testify about what's going on in our community, what are people reading, how do we select literature. They already have the cards stacked against us because it's people who are setting the agenda will invite the people who tell them what they want to hear. The Saudi government did have some influence by having somebody who had experience in foreign relations with them to sort of debunk some of what was being said, and it was covered on C-SPAN. And then they also had the head of one of the masjids that they had targeted to be able to say, this really is not reflective of our community, and it's really not appropriate to be targeting us in that way. So they did modify it somewhat because of pressure, which is what we'll come back to, why we have to be strengthening ourselves in that regard. The third way is to co-opt us. Again, the idea being to minimize the influence or to take control over it. And what has been an interesting phenomenon is the creation and promotion of the good Muslim, right? The reformist Muslim. Who is the one we want to promote as the identity of the right kind of Muslim living in America? This has particularly happened in Los Angeles with the LA Times and certain individuals that they would highlight and promote as if they're the most forward-thinking Muslim that ever was. Nobody else ever had any of the ideas that they did. And that really they're the ones who get, you know, who are on television, who are interviewed and so forth, whose books get published, who get invited to speak. But what qualifies them as good Muslims is that, number one, they engage in a lot of self-bashing, right? So that we've had this experience of trying to submit op-ed pieces to the LA Times, that if you didn't have enough language in there that said, yes, we're bad, we're horrible, we've done so many terrible things, and then you get to say your piece or what your point is about trying, don't marginalize Muslims in America. If you don't have enough of that sort of self-flagellating language, they're not going to publish what you say. Also, if you're in general agreement with U.S. policy, particularly as it relates to the Middle East, the Iraq War, and the situation in Israel-Palestine. And so some of the examples of that are Irshad Manji. Has anyone heard of Irshad? She's a Canadian Muslim of South Asian background who has written a book called The Trouble with Islam. Now, she changed the title to The Trouble with Islam today because people asked her the question, if Islam is such a problem, why are you even still a Muslim? And she said, well, I'm waiting for things to get better and then I'll decide. But she has come out and challenges different groups as not doing enough, as Muslims being the source of problems, and the Quran needs to be revised and certain pieces of it, you know, deleted and so forth. And so she's basically saying what certain elements want to hear, and then she gets propped up as being the voice of moderate, good Islam, even though she doesn't represent anybody within the Muslim community. In her book, at one point, she writes about how she stood on the shores of a settlement in Gaza, and at that point, she could really understand the whole purpose and focus of Israel's existence. I mean, so she really declared her allegiance at that point, and is a frequent guest at dinners with Anti-Defamation League, which is how I first heard of her, from one of my patients who was at an ADL dinner and said, oh, I heard this woman speak, she's wonderful, you've got to see her. But again, here's the idea that certain individuals get propped up as being the you know, the good and proper Muslim. And in this way, it sort of takes the voice away from the authentic community that's been here for a long time and working on so many issues, whether it's women's rights, minority rights, just establishing our identity, as if we don't exist. And it's sort of that notion of, you know, looking at us as if we aren't here that has plagued us for a long, long time. Now, my experience is that, at least during the Clinton administration, maybe this wouldn't have happened had 9/11 happened back then, but there seemed to be a lot more opportunities and an outreach within the towards the Muslim community. I was on the U.S. delegation to the Fourth World Conference on Women in Beijing in 1995, and I remember being at one session and someone I met. What would happen is, this was my first sort of introduction to some of the strange politics of Washington, is that you had the delegation that was there, but then you also had people from the right who were there to monitor the delegation and make sure they didn't get too out of control on certain women's issues, right? Whether it had to do with especially sexual reproductive rights. And I met one of these women who was, you know, from the right wing, and she was like, why are you even involved? You know, you share more of the conservative values as we do. And I said, well, you know, it just so happens they're the ones who invited us. I wouldn't be on this because I'm a Democrat or Republican. It's just because this is an opportunity. And she said, oh, well, I'm sure that when the Republicans are in power, they'll invite you just as much. And the truth is that that has not happened by any means. And I'm not making a partisan statement, because I personally have lost faith in all parties in Washington. But we did have some opportunities back then. Being with that delegation meant meeting people in the State Department, meant building bridges, and a lot of people were much more open-minded and inclusive at that time. And then that opened the door for being a part of this advisory committee on religious freedom abroad, and then the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, which was a baptism by fire. If you'll forgive that metaphor, but you know, since we're Muslims, obviously, but because that was a real introduction to the fight that we're up against in Washington. But the Clintons did have Ramadan iftars. They've started that tradition within the White House, State Department, the Pentagon, and all different branches of government. They have not really been well sustained. They've now turned into basically invitations to embassy staff. Right, so the Muslims, instead of being American Muslims who come to celebrate Ramadan, which is, you know, a holiday we are celebrating here, they invite the staff from the embassies of all the Muslim countries, or the ambassadors. And so that way they get away from validating any of us or having to choose among us to say who the good Muslims and bad Muslims are, because in the end they're really, according to their definition, which is a good Muslim is the one who supports the policy, they can't really find anybody. And in general, this administration has been much less open. And so, for example, if there's an event, this came up recently, where someone had suggested me to come and speak on women's issues, and they said, no, she's a Democrat, or she's affiliated with the Democratic Party. which again, you know, is only because it was a timing issue. So that who's going to turn down an opportunity to represent our community, whether they're Democrat or Republican, but then all of a sudden you get punished for it later because they put that label on you when that's really not a label that I put on myself. And so that kind of partisanship and politicization is very real and very problematic for us. Being on the Commission on Religious Freedom, you know, I had not been a conspiracy theorist up until that time, but it was being around people like the person who was responsible later for doing this report from Freedom House that I told you about, Nina Shea. I served on that commission with John Bolton. Has everybody heard of John Bolton? He's worse than what they said in the paper. And Elliot Abrams, who was, I think, indicted, or if not convicted, for lying during the Iran-Contra affair. It's a very strong Zionist, who now works in for the National Security Council under Condoleezza Rice and is the number one person after her in the Middle East, Israel-Palestine. But I remember getting started on this commission thinking, again, it's great, interfaith, people from different groups, Baha'is, Jews, Buddhists, Muslims, Christians. But the problem was, this was born out of the International Religious Freedom Act, which talked about, which was basically a way to expose how the Clinton administration wasn't doing enough to help Christians around the world. And it started out as an issue that was going to look at the persecution of Christians, Jews, Buddhists, and Baha'is. And it wasn't until other voices said, you know, if you're going to talk about religious freedom, shouldn't you talk about all groups? So I was one of the people appointed by the president to this commission. Others were appointed by different branches of government, depending if they were Republican or Democrat. It was supposed to be bipartisan, non-political, but wow, it really was something else, because some elements really looked at it as an opportunity to expose the weaknesses of the Clinton administration. You're not. This was when the issue of Sudan was very important, right, when the whole idea of Christian persecution in southern Sudan was a big issue. Saudi Arabia came up as an issue, again, about Wahhabism and about the persecution of Christians, and women who work there from Philippines aren't allowed, there's no churches, and so on and so on and so. And it was an odyssey and a nightmare that lasted for 2 years. And time, after being exposed to the anti-Muslim sentiment that was just so in your face you can't even believe it, I would say, what am I doing here? Am I really accomplishing anything? I mean, and I would pray about it because it was really difficult, and I'll just share a couple of the stories to tell you why. And I felt my goal was really quite simple. It was to bring to light the issues that would otherwise be ignored. Like to talk about the fact that in Egypt, so that was a high priority issue because of the strong Coptic community in this country, that Muslims experience persecution under the Egyptian government if they disagree with Egyptian policy. That whether or not I may have agreements or disagreements about Ikhwan or other groups, that people who get labeled an Islamist or, you know, have the label of terrorist put on them and are subjected to detention, military detention that can last 6 months or longer and are tortured in prison. What about their religious freedom? And so it was to highlight the fact that Muslims living in Muslim countries are persecuted because of their faith. And that was a big issue for me because, number one, it showed that I was not afraid to criticize Muslim governments or to simply give them a rubber stamp saying, well, they're Muslims, I'm going to give them a free pass, because I don't think that's right for us as Muslims. The Quran tells us to be just and stand for justice, bear witness to the truth, even if it's against your own selves. And then secondly, it was to show people that it's not so simplistic, and you can't go around sort of claiming you're a champion for religious freedom and neglect the majority population who are affected by these policies. We were, you know, brought to light the plight of Muslims living in China. Again, the persecuted church in China was a big issue about these underground churches. But the problems faced by Muslims are quite unbelievable. They're not allowed to fast in Ramadan. They are involved, that what they're doing now is forced migration, or they're actually just demographic distribution. So they're having Han Chinese who are non-Muslim all migrate to the western provinces of China to dilute the Muslim population. Of course, everywhere in the world now, you can just say somebody is a terrorist, Islamist, and whatever, and nobody's going to question the kinds of crackdowns and human rights violations. But so that was my role, to sort of bring these things to light, to give people that voice. And to sort of be a thorn in their side, as it were. once, they've of course kept talking about how horrible Sharia was for non-Muslims and so on and so forth, and I suggested, look, you know, you talk about this term as if everybody knows what it means. Muslims themselves don't really understand the full scope of what Sharia is, so why don't we have, just among ourselves, the 10 commissioners and the staff, a presentation or discussion about some of these basic concepts of Islamic law and some of the nuances and where any flexibility is. And they kept telling me, no, we don't need to do that, we don't want to do that, of course, because it was coming from me. So one day, and this was in the winter when it was raining and cold and snowing, and I was 9-10 months pregnant at the time. I was going to pass on the meeting because they were having them every month, and this was kind of hard for me to fly out to Washington, fly back, and miss work and all kinds of things. And sometimes I would be on the phone, which was very frustrating. And so I happened to call the director and say, so what's on the agenda for this meeting? Oh, Bernard Lewis is coming to talk about Islam. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. I said, you know, because I had been suggesting that for a long time, and Elliot Abrams had invited him, a good friend of his. I said, I have a huge problem with that. You know, that's like me inviting one of my Muslim colleagues and scholars to talk about Judaism. Who would even accept that? When you have prominent, qualified members of that faith to be able not only either to speak to the issue or to bring somebody who can. And so it was interesting because I forced Elliot to talk to me about this because he sort of was being a little bit evasive, and he said he didn't think he needed to get my permission since he was the chair of the commission at the time. I said, well, it's a matter of courtesy. You have Cardinal, who was an archbishop at the time, Theodore McCarrick, on the commission. I would kind of assume that out of respect you would run it by him if you were going to bring an expert, a non-Catholic expert, to talk about the issues of religious freedom and Catholicism, or Firuz Kazemzadeh, the Baha'i member. I know that you would talk to them. And so I ended up insisting on bringing an alternative speaker. So John Esposito was gracious enough to agree to come. It was very short notice. It was less than a week. And Elliot refused to have them be on the same panel because he didn't want, Bernard Lewis to lower himself to be in a debate because he's such a prominent scholar. And so that's what ended up happening. I had to fly out so that I could have a presence and say, this is really not acceptable to do these kinds of things. So they're on a very small scale, and nobody outside had any idea this was going on. But it seemed very important to me at the time because this is the kinds of ways that they attempt to take advantage of us, exploit our weaknesses, right? Here I am pregnant, living on the other side of the country, and, you know, if I'm not able to be there, wouldn't that be perfect? You'll have this one Muslim from the commission not be able to be there and challenge the non-Muslim expert when they're talking about Islam and religious freedom. And he ended up talking about something that happened, I don't know, back in the 16th century, and rabbits were involved in his story, and rabbit meat, and I was complaining. He was really, it was just horrible, and of course Esposito was fantastic, and people could really see the difference. But that was just one example of many where at one point they had invited John Garang from the Sudan, who recently was killed in a helicopter accident, who is the head of this SPLA, this Sudanese People's Liberation Army, the main force fighting against the North and the government for their freedom. And so he came and was speaking. Again, I couldn't be at that meeting, but I'm sure I wanted to be on the phone. And so I had a question, and what happened was he was speaking, and one of the most interesting things he said was, we have to do something about the appeal of Islam to the young people. And I wanted to ask the question, you know, I mean, you've painted a picture of this brutal Islamic regime. How could anybody be attracted to Islam if that's sort of the image and message that's being transferred to them from within the government and from these, you know, militias that are coming down and killing them? And, of course, as soon as I started to ask the question, John Bolton said, that's all the time we have for questions, and that was it, and he completely cut me off. And it was so that there couldn't be any debate. And so it was that kind of sort of control. I tend not to be a person who likes conflict, so instead I developed an ulcer. I had an eye twitch. You know, thank God, alhamdulillah, my daughter was born healthy. But because I really, that kind of sort of bad faith undermining people really is so against the way I believe and the way I do things. A few months later, in May of 2000, my dad, Ali Arhamu, passed away very suddenly. And so here I was, having had a new baby, my dad had passed away, and still these kinds of things were going on, whereas, you know, kick them when they're down. So I have my own experience, but with influential people in Washington, just to let you know that that kind of attitude is very real, especially about preventing us from having access. They wanted to go on a trip to the Middle East. They wanted to go to Saudi Arabia and Egypt, and so I insisted that we go to Israel. Because I said, if you're talking about religious freedom in Egypt, you can't do that without talking about religious freedom issues in Israel, even among Jews themselves. And so I prevailed, and we did go. And at the end of these trips, you would produce some kind of a written document saying what were the findings were. So we went. This was in March. Our term would expire on May 15th. We were continuing to have debates and discussion, couldn't come to any agreement, right? Because to some people in the commission, Israel is not guilty of any human rights violations of any kind whatsoever, ever, ever, never. And so they couldn't come up with an acceptance. And what I figured was happening was that they were running down the clock so that May 15th would come, and we, as the commission as it was, could no longer issue a statement because our term was over. So in anticipation of that, I prepared my own. So that it was my statement as a dissent from their decision not to issue something was a good discussion of the serious religious freedom issues without being overly critical or being, you know, hyperbolic or anything. And it was part of the public record, which is still on the commission's website, because it went out on May 14th. And those kinds of sort of subtle, insidious ways, not telling you that a hearing is going to happen, letting you know 2 days before, can you come and testify? No, my life isn't organized that way. Well, we did ask somebody, but they couldn't come. So you see these kinds of little games that people play, which is why I could never live in Washington, and I tell my husband, don't even think about going there. I had hoped that being on the commission would be a way to open doors for future generations, but that doesn't seem to have happened. Since then, the other Muslim that they appointed after I left was Khalil Abu Fadl, who's a professor at UCLA who doesn't go to any of the meetings because he's ill and he's busy with his profession. So they really don't have a Muslim voice on the commission, and it doesn't really serve much of a purpose anyway, because its full purpose was to bash President Clinton back in those days. I think in terms of these external challenges and being involved in government, we don't have enough of a presence at all in Washington. So when these things come up, you don't have Muslim lobbyists. The organizations that we think are there are not there on Capitol Hill, banging down the doors of these senators and congressmen saying you can't have this kind of thing without having a Muslim voice. You do have individuals working in different offices and in different departments, in justice or treasury and so forth, but there's really no organized effort. That's a huge weakness that we have to overcome. And that's something that we can talk about, perhaps, as ways to get past that, because we just do not have an effective grassroots nationwide lobbying organization that advocates on issues important to Muslim Americans. Not certain Muslim countries. Those guys are doing pretty well, I would say. But the interests of those of us living here and who call this our home.
listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. This is another installment of Voices of the Middle East, and I'm Gudar Zaktadari, your host. The first part of the program, you were listening to Dr. Leila Mayati, who had a lecture here last Friday for Muslim Educational Trust in Portland, and talked about the struggle of American Muslims these days. Now I'm going to another part of the program. My guest tonight is Dr. Lisa Hajar. She's a professor at University of California, Santa Barbara, and an associate professor in Law and Society program, and also the author of Curtain Conflict: The Israeli Military Court System in the West Bank and Gaza, published by University of California. And without further ado, I have Dr. Hajar online. Welcome to the program, Lisa. Hello? Hello, welcome back, Dr. Hajar.
Yes, hi.
Okay, thanks for accepting the invitation. And as I was telling the audience, you have written a book on the Israeli military court system in the West Bank, and you have been speaking about the issues recently on the secret detention sites of this U.S. government in Europe and elsewhere.
Well, I've been writing generally about the issue of sort of the whole American torture scandal. I have an article that just is appearing today on The Nation, in The Nation magazine. It's online now, called An Army of Lawyers.
Okay. Let me start with, would you give us a kind of a brief introduction to the cases that CIA, secret detention and interrogation in general, and the specific case of the people who are now known to be treated this way, like Khaled al-Masri and Mahmoud Habibi and Mohammed Ulad Salhi and also Saad Iqbal. What do you know about their cases and how they have been sort of kidnapped and, in a way, interrogated for a long period of time in unknown sites? And what do we know about those sites?
Okay, well, just to provide a little bit of background, you know, early on in the war on terror, when the United States started utilizing, you know, policy or practices that would constitute torture and ill treatment against people that they were capturing, it immediately became obvious that this would put U.S. agents at risk if they were engaging in these practices in the United States or somewhere where U.S. courts would have jurisdiction. So that was one reason why Guantanamo was established. But even Guantanamo was a place where the people sent to Guantanamo were mainly people considered to be, if they, you know, they were assumed to be kind of small potatoes. None of the people that were captured who were assumed to be high-value targets were ever sent to Guantanamo, with the exception of Mohammed al-Qahtani. So those people were picked up either in Afghanistan or in other countries and mainly transferred into CIA custody. So one form of interrogation was that conducted by the CIA itself. And so on that score, we have a number of issues happening. One thing, the CIA operated secret sites or sites within larger military bases in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and elsewhere, but that U.S. military personnel and certainly military laws were not considered applicable to the CIA. And so many people were brutally interrogated in these CIA detention sites. Many of the people in CIA custody, I mean, early on, again, in I think 2003, the Pentagon basically declared that people who were in CIA custody would not have access to, or the International Committee of the Red Cross would not have access to these people. So for all intents and purposes, beyond, the CIA custodians themselves and, you know, other members of the Pentagon, people were being disappeared into CIA custody, you know, where the Red Cross would have no access to them and no one would really know their fate and whereabouts. The other thing that has happened, and I'll come back to the question of CIA custody in a moment, but some prisoners who were interrogated by the CIA and then not considered to be so crucial to ongoing investigations, but who were either had been extremely brutalized themselves or were considered maybe still significant, just not significant enough for the CIA, were then rendered over to other countries, you know, including countries with well-established records of torture, including Syria, Egypt, Jordan, and Morocco. So on that score, the CIA was then transferring some people out of its own custody into the custody of other governments. And we know that, for example, Maher Arar, a Canadian citizen who was picked up as he was transiting through Kennedy Airport in 2002, I believe, was sent by the CIA to Syria, where he underwent, you know, many months of brutal interrogation and then subsequently was released because it was clear that he actually had absolutely no connection to terrorism and so on. So he's, in fact, returned to Canada and is now suing Donald Rumsfeld and others for having ordered his rendition. But there's about 100, or at least it's estimated to be about 100 prisoners who are really these, you know, presumably, well, at least that they've been really disappeared in CIA custody. 30 of them, you know, including Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Abu Zubaydah and Ramzi bin Shabib and others, are considered to be quote-unquote high-value targets. There's about 30 of that category estimated by sort of people watching this. And another 70, it's completely unknown what their identity is or what their significance is, if they have any connections to Al-Qaeda, or if so or not, what that would be. The CIA was operating essentially secret prisons, not only in countries where the U.S. military was operating, like Iraq and Afghanistan, but also in other countries. So, for example, Abu Zubaydah was the first high-level Al-Qaeda suspect to be captured, and he was initially located in a secret CIA facility in Thailand. But when news of that came out, the Thai government was embarrassed, and then the CIA subsequently located him elsewhere. What we've learned since November, when the Washington Post produced an article, which was really the one that's been, you know, kind of roiling the world lately, is that, you know, among the places where the CIA was operating some of these secret prisons included on the continent of Europe. Now, there are several problems. One is that, you know, it's in the continent of Europe, including in countries that are U.S. allies, perhaps unbeknownst at least to the general publics of those countries. But also problematic is the fact that Europe has a very strong and enforceable set of human rights laws. And so this created a whole set of problems for European governments, for the U.S. government, and for the CIA. When that story came out in early November, as reported by Dana Priest in the Washington Post, it immediately forced the CIA to scramble to get all of the secret detainees whichever ones might be located on the European continent, out of Europe. And apparently the latest news is that they've been relocated to some secret site somewhere in North Africa, although to my knowledge, the location has not been identified yet.
As far as international law and basically Universal Declaration of Human Rights, how these practices, I mean, obviously they are in violation of international human rights law, and in Europe specifically, you mentioned, it is in contradiction with the European Union code of practice. And
right.
Any country in Europe can be questioned for this kind of activity.
Mm-hmm.
But we hear that, for example, the Interior Minister of Germany, Otto Schily, was informed about this, but was asked not to say anything or not disclose it.
Right.
And I don't really understand why would a foreign ambassador go and meet with the Interior Minister instead of foreign minister in Germany,
mm-hmm.
and share this kind of information about Mr. Masri's abduction. And then now, for example, Condi Rice, in her trip to Germany during the meeting with Angela Merkel, admits the erroneous activities of CIA. But in fact, I mean, these are violations, aren't they?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, so one way of thinking about it, you know, and I think one way of explaining what's been going on from the European point of view, and also to understand the contents of Condoleezza Rice's statements once she's been in Europe. One thing is that, I mean, as you know, it happens in this country and elsewhere, that some agencies of the government will operate, you know, in ways that are unbeknownst to other agencies of the government, especially those that are dealing with security operations, and certainly to the public. So we know, for example, that in the Swedish government, you know, and Sweden has a very strong track record on human rights issues, but around the question, you know, in collaborating with the United States, you know, under the assumption that this is a shared mission to combat terrorism and catch, you know, the perpetrators of the 9/11 attacks and other attacks, you know, members of the security services in Sweden helped the CIA initially to actually capture two people in Sweden, but then once they were still physically in Sweden, the CIA took custody of them in an airport, in a Swedish airport, and the Swedish government officials saw what was going on, that these two men were sort of stripped naked, given tranquilizing enemas, put in diapers, and put on a plane, and then sent off to Egypt, where it was subsequently revealed that they were tortured. And you know, even the security agents in Sweden were a bit alarmed at the time. But as that story broke, and other sectors of the government and the public learned about that, it was, you know, one could say on the one hand, well, quote, Sweden helped the United States in its extraordinary renditions. Indeed. But it was one sector of the Swedish government, and now there's been a crisis in Sweden. Same goes for the Berlusconi government in Italy, where the Berlusconi government, in fact, helped the CIA also kidnap people from Italy and move them elsewhere. And once that information became public, now you see the legal system, you know, the prosecutorial office in Italy now naming, or at least seeking to indict, 21 CIA agents who operated on Italian soil in violation of Italian and international laws. So while the Italian government, you know, or one sector of it, participated with the U.S. government in renditions, another sector is now fighting against it. Same goes for Spain. I mean, in the sense that at least it's been alleged that planes transporting prisoners around the world have landed in many countries, including in Spain. And now a sector of the Spanish government is seeking some kind of legal recourse for the fact that, you know, disappeared prisoners actually set down on Spanish soil, which gives Spain a kind of territorial claim to its law enforcement. What this means then, and what we're hearing Condoleezza Rice saying, she's trying to appeal to a certain kind of an argument, which is that you know, all of these countries are menaced by terrorism. The need to combat terrorism is a collective action. She's more or less continuing on in the Bush policy line, which is that the law should be no obstacle. But she's essentially appealing to people to see security and the law as contradictory and to prioritize security, and to indicate that there have been people in the various European governments who see the world the same way the Bush administration sees the world, even though there are other people in the government and much stronger laws in Europe that make this now an incredibly complicated issue diplomatically and a fluid issue legally.
And as far as, I guess, recourse, how we know that ACLU filed a lawsuit on behalf of Khaled al-Masri.
Yes.
And what base are they going to be able to follow this up, and whether it's not going to be thrown out of court because of administrative power, for example?
Well, one way of thinking about the prospect of prosecuting people involved in torture, and by involvement that includes, since torture and other forms of abuse are illegal, but then one has to think about, okay, so which laws apply to which people and how can you enforce those laws? So let me just mention one thing, that for U.S. members of the U.S. military, anyone who wears a U.S. uniform is subject to the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which actually enshrines the Geneva Conventions. And the Geneva Conventions actually prohibit, regardless of the status of prisoners, those rules govern U.S. soldiers. And so many soldiers are now, who've engaged in abusive practices, are liable for prosecution. Not only the soldiers directly involved in abusing prisoners, but everybody up the chain of command in some ways could be subject to those laws. Now, the other thing for the CIA is that because they're not members of the military, but there are U.S. laws and certainly international laws that have universal, that have extraterritorial jurisdiction. But to actually prosecute people, what we're seeing now in terms of the prosecution of people who've been responsible for torture, we're seeing well over 100 U.S. low-ranking soldiers have now been, faced prosecution or administrative penalties for these abuses. But people up the chain of command, including Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and others, have not at all been subject to any kind of accountability for this. What happens is that other countries, including Germany, including Spain, the Scandinavian countries, have certain kinds of laws that make it possible to prosecute foreigners in the courts of these other countries if those foreigners are not prosecuted in their own country. So this is why the issue is still so fluid. For example, a case that was brought in Germany on behalf of some torture victims from Iraq and Afghanistan, naming Donald Rumsfeld, General Ricardo Sanchez, and others for abuses that took place in Iraq. Germany has a very strong law, but basically kicked the case out, at least for now, on the grounds that it's not we don't yet know if the U.S. will prosecute its own. So there's this, the vague sense of when will it be clear to foreign courts that the U.S. is unwilling to pursue accountability and enforcement of the law up the chain of command. So time becomes a factor. And you see, in the case of, a former dictator of Chile, Augusto Pinochet, sometimes these cases, or Hassan Habré of Chad, these cases are pursued years after a person is out of office, but they never die because there's no statute of limitations for the prosecution of torture.
I guess I want to ask a question, whether the United States not signing into international court would make any difference?
No, in my opinion, no. I actually have I'm critical of the International Criminal Court for the reason that it's very much subject to the dynamics of, state power on the international system. So I think it makes it, it's much easier and more likely to prosecute people from smaller or weaker or, rogue states than it is to prosecute someone in the International Court, Criminal Court, from a powerful country. The ICC, you know, I mean, the ICC were all the countries in the world to sign on to it. It would be a logical venue. However, the other alternative is the one that many people are now seeking, which is something called universal jurisdiction. And torture in particular, I mean, unlike almost any other crime, torture attaches universal jurisdiction, which means that it's always a crime everywhere, and therefore people, at least in principle, can be prosecuted for the crime of torture anywhere. And so this universal jurisdiction was the factor that was being used in, you know, in the Pinochet case when Spain was seeking to indict Pinochet and transport him from England. It's also the grounds for bringing a case in Germany. It's the grounds for bringing a case in Italy now against the CIA agents and other things. The idea that torture is such a clear and prohibited crime that it must be prosecuted, and any, you know, legitimate court system can be a venue for the prosecution of torture.
With your knowledge about the kind of systems around the world, I would like to ask whether you have been exposed to any similar practice in other countries. The picture is pretty much like a Hollywood movie, like folks coming in a black outfit with ski hoods, and they grab somebody on the street and put them in the car and go. And
absolutely, I mean, in fact, it's, you know, to some extent, it's reminiscent of a number of different kinds of contexts. And I mean, for example, during the dirty wars in Latin America, it was, you know, the state agents of the various military regimes would go around and pick up people or disappear them. You know, it was often indicated that some of these folks, you know, these security agents would be wearing hoods and black outfits, or some basically in ways that would make them unidentifiable, so that both they couldn't be identified and then their activities could subsequently be denied, you know, so that there would be no evidence left. So one can say you could see that certainly in the Latin American context during the dirty wars. As far as the actual interrogation practices go, my particular expertise is on Israel-Palestine, and, you know, I mean, one can say that there's a great number of ways in which Israeli practices have served, you know, for better and worse, as a model for the United States government. So on the one hand, you know, Israeli interrogation practices vis-a-vis Palestinians are different than, say, interrogation and torture practices in a more, you know, sort of obvious dictatorship like Syria or, you know, Iraq under Saddam Hussein, where there was no need, you know, security forces could just go wherever they wanted, pick up people and take them away. They didn't even need to articulate what they were doing in a legal framework or to even excuse themselves because, you know, the media was repressed and so on. Whereas in a country like Israel, where there's a high level of expectation for at least the public to know and understand that the government is acting legitimately, the Israeli government, since, you know, really the 1980s, went to great lengths to explain its interrogation policies as legal. So even though these policies would, you know, many people would argue that they constitute torture, they were justified and sort of brought into the legal system on the grounds that claiming that they were not torture, but they were, quote, moderate physical pressure. You know, and then the purposes being served by these interrogation practices, as far as the Israeli government was concerned, that you have to be able to coercively interrogate Palestinians because of the threat of ticking bombs. Although the ticking bombs in those scenarios really were Palestinian nationalism was the main ticking bomb at the time, and since the 90s or the late 80s, it's really become sort of, in addition, Islamic, violence and so on. But in that regard, I think that's a model for the U.S. in two ways. One, trying to argue that what is being done is somehow legal if you interpret the law in a certain way. And the second argument is that, the tactics used themselves are ones that are, you know, for example, using less tactics that don't leave physical marks. So, for example, even the most, what we know of as the most sort of, you know, one that's a tactic that's gotten a lot of press, waterboarding, you know, to immerse someone's head in water to make that person believe that he or she is about to be drowned. You know, drowning doesn't leave any marks, and so one can waterboard somebody, scare them, you know, to presumably then, you know, fearing for their life, and then the presumption is that they would then start speaking, although if one is fearing for his or her life, the likelihood that what they're going to say is true becomes highly dubious. But so waterboarding is a tactic that, you know, is preferred because it doesn't leave marks. Or position abuse. Again, this is something that the Israelis use incredibly extensively. It's like tying prisoners in painful positions so that their own body begins to work against them. Their muscles cramp, you know, that they go into incredible pain, or sleep deprivation. Things like these that can be done to break people. But then it becomes, you know, because interrogation occurs in secret sites, it then becomes the word of the prisoner versus words of the state, you know, or the words of the state. And, you know, without marks, it's difficult to prove allegations of torture.
Well, thank you, Dr. Hajar. I'm sorry we are getting to the end of the show, and I would like to invite you to another program maybe in the near future and discuss more issues. And thanks again for,
thank you for having me,
for accepting my invitation.
Thank you.
Good night.
Bye-bye.